Morning. It's good to be back with you again. It's been a few months, right? I always enjoy being with you. Well, the last time I was here, we were in the book of Romans. In fact, the last few times. And there's lots in the book of Romans, so I thought I'd take another passage out of the book. We're not going strictly sentence by sentence, but I'm jumping around and hitting some of the highlights of the book of Romans. Hopefully it'll draw your interest in reading it. It's not an easy book. In fact, book of Romans is probably the most, well, it is the most theological book of the whole Bible. I was going to say the New Testament, but you'd say that for the whole Bible. So lots of theology, you might say. Lots of argumentation. Paul argues point after point, builds upon one point, continues building and building and building. And obviously he has some major themes. We've looked at a few of those. But even though it is the most theological of all books, there also is a very practical and a section that applies very directly to us. In fact, you could divide the book into two major parts, the theological portion all the way through the end of chapter 11, and then in chapter 12, we begin the what most theologians call the practical or the more applicable areas that now he's going to apply the doctrines that he's laid out. So I'd like to get us started in first two verses there. And I guess the main, if you want to summarize it in one word, he's talking about, now that you know, now that you have the theology, now that you have the foundation, now you need to make a commitment to living it out. And that's the essence of what he's going to do in chapters 12 all the way to the end of the book. Apart from the conclusion that actually is a long conclusion that begins in chapter 15. So beginning in chapter 12, beginning in verse 1, he's going to deal with what do we commit to? What does Christianity look like? Now that he's described it and the essence of it and how we enter into it, he's given us principles for living the Christian life, but even those were theological. The emphasis was primarily the doctrines of sanctification. But now in chapter 12, verse 1, he's going to actually apply and call for some commitments. You may have noticed even the grammar, I'll bring that out in a moment, but the grammar is going to change from indicative mood, those of you that are grammarians, in other words, statements of fact. Beginning in chapter 12, what's the alternative? Obviously, statements of fact. And then now, what is he going to do? Anyone suggest? Rather than indicative, imperative. In other words, command after command after command, or exhortation, exhortation, encouragement after encouragement. So you'll see that even in the grammar. So beginning in verse 1, obviously to a particular audience. And I select this slide with that title because not everyone in the first century had an easy life. In fact, most believers had a very difficult life. Colosseum was noted for several things, games particularly, but a lot of Christians died there. In other words, they took a stand, made a commitment to the point that they were willing to die. And Romans 1 kind of illustrates what that looks like. In other words, what does it look like to live for God, and what does a commitment to Him look like? And of all of the passages of the Scriptures, I think we have a summary here of what the Christian life should look like, moment by moment, day by day. And he's going to go through a series of different areas of what the Christian life looks like. And he's going to begin with one. So let me give you kind of a overview to give you the context. Context is always important. First eight chapters, he's going to talk about soteriology, the doctrine of soteriology. And he's going to talk about the condemnation of all of humanity In other words, the lostness, the futility of trying to reach God on one's own efforts, that fails, so we stand condemned. And then within that, he's going to talk about the solution to our problem is Jesus Christ and justification, another theological term, how we can get salvation, you might say, or how may we have a right standing, that's justification, a righteous standing before God. And then he's going to apply it in terms of principles. What are the principles for living it out, beginning in chapter 6 through chapter 8? So he's providing the righteousness that only can come from God, and that righteousness is available to us as sinners. And it's not just for salvation, but it's for the ongoing experience of the Christian life. And then he's going to deal with an issue that was prevalent in the first century, and I call it vindication. There were some issues. Well, you're introducing some new things here, Paul. We Jewish people, we've heard about Old Testament righteousness. We've heard about some of these things. But aren't the Jewish people God's people? Aren't we the people of God? Doesn't God have covenants and a relationship with us that are unending? In other words, the Abrahamic covenant, the aspects of the Mosaic covenant. Doesn't God treat us as his people? And the answer is yes. Well, what's this new thing, this church thing that you're talking about? What's this new relationship? So he's going to vindicate God's righteousness by explaining why he has to set aside the nation of Israel, but it's not a permanent setting aside. It is a temporary one until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. So it's an unfolding of an aspect of God's plan that he hasn't revealed. Some aspects are not revealed in the Old Testament, and the New Testament calls it a mystery. But then there's going to come a day when all of Israel shall be saved. So he's going to vindicate the God's righteousness in that you might accuse God of, well, are you violating your principles? Are you violating your righteousness? Are you going back on your covenants and your promises? And the answer is absolutely not. God is dealing in a different way, in a different time frame. But there'll come a day when all of Israel will be saved. So his righteousness is vindicated. And then at the end of chapter 11, that's the end of the theological portion that moves us to the applicational portion that runs through chapter 15, verse 13. And then there's a conclusion. I don't show the conclusion on the slide there. And just very quickly, we're just going to look at the beginning of it because it's foundational and everything else depends on it, for one thing. But he's going to deal with, what does it look like, this Christian life that you've introduced, what does it look like in relationship to God? In other words, moment by moment, day by day, what does it look like? And he's going to spend just two verses, but they're packed full. We may not even get done today. You know me, towards the end, I'm cramming to try to get everything in. But we'll see how far we can get. So two verses on that relationship, packed full of what it looks like. And then he's going to extend the circle beyond God, and the next circle will be what does it look like in relationship to one another. And in that, he's going to deal with our relationship to the church, the practical outworking of the principles that he's laid out relating to salvation or justification and relating to sanctification. That runs through chapter 12, 3 through 21. Then he's going to extend the circle. What does it look like in relationship to the external world or society or the unbelieving world that we have to live in? And he's going to deal with that relationship. What does it look like in that relationship? Then he's going to deal with a particular issue, chapter 14 through 15, 13, in terms of Christian liberty. What does all of this look like in terms of relationships with one another in the area of Christian liberty? On an outline, you can put the same thing on an outline. That was in chart form. So provision of God's righteousness through the end of chapter 8, vindication 9 through 11, application 12:1 through 15:13, And he's going to start off with the application relating to God. So two ways I've given it to you to kind of reinforce it. Chart form, outline form. First part, verse 1, I summarize by calling this the presenting of oneself to God. In other words, that's the commitment. So what Christianity should look like is a day-by-day, moment-by-moment presenting of ourselves, making ourselves available to God. He's going to expand upon that, but that's kind of a summary of verse 1, at least my summary. And he's going to plead now. Remember, he's been laying out the facts of soteriology, the theology, the doctrine, and now he's going to encourage and exhort and try to call for a response. That's why we call it the applicational or the practical portion of the book. So we have a beginning here, and it starts off with therefore. And this is a huge therefore. Therefore always points to something beforehand, right? And it's pointing to the first 11 chapters of the book. I think you can go all the way to the very beginning of the doctrinal section that begins after the introduction, obviously, all the way back to verse 18 of chapter 1. Therefore, based on everything that I've said, based on everything that is laid out, based on this big doctrine of justification and sanctification, these doctrines of soteriology, now there's something that has to come about. You need to make it a reality in terms of you personally. So therefore, a big therefore, it includes lots of things. It includes, I think, everything that he said up to this point. So we could come up with a long list here. Therefore, we have the theology, indicative mood, I've already mentioned, and now the application, imperative mood. In other words, commandments or encouragements. You could also describe it as the reality of what God has done for us in Christ and the reality of what has happened to those that are justified, the reality of what happens as we walk with God in terms of sanctification. And now he's going to talk about the responsibility or the part that we have in terms of seeing it worked out in our experience. So reality and responsibility, doctrine, and now duty, if you want to look at it from that perspective. You could also call it the principles. We've talked a lot about the principles, theological principles. Now we can call it practice. Different ways of framing the same thing. But the therefore, chapters 1 through 11, therefore, now we have the duty, the responsibility, the practice, the application. We have divine revelation. These are the truths that God has revealed concerning soteriology. Now we have human responsibility. How do I respond to it? You might call the first 11 chapters the foundation, the thinking, the foundational thoughts, as opposed to now living it out moment by moment. The life experience. You have to have both. Sometimes we as Christians have a lot of head knowledge. We have a lot of input. But that's as far as it goes. Chapters 12 to the end encourage us to live it out. Live out the things that we believe. So what does the Christian life look like lived out in everyday situations? And he's going to start off, obviously, with what does it look like in relationship to God himself. So, therefore, and now we have the first urging, not a strong command, you might say, but he's just pleading, you might say, urging, encouraging. In fact, there's a series of words throughout here that I'm going to highlight and look at to make sure that we understand them. If we understand them, hopefully it'll translate into the commitment that is encouraged here. So I urge you, and notice he appeals to them not as a superior above everybody else, but Paul as a brother. In other words, I'm in this with you. I'm trying to live the same Christian life with you. I'm your brother. I experience everything that you experience. We're on the same level. And I'm urging you. I'm encouraging, and this it's not a strong command, but it's a strong word in terms of encouragement. And I'll give you some of the Greek words, parakaleo. You might be familiar with that one. It's found in several contexts. In fact, it's a common word. To urge, like we have here, most of the times, 23 times. But it also, in some context, to comfort. So he's encouraging. In order to experience some comfort, we need to live these things out. So it's translated in some context to in comfort, and these are mainly New American Standard translations in different contexts, or imploring you, that's similar to urging, exhorting, just trying to motivate here, encouragement, and that's the theme of the rest of the book of Romans. And by the mercies of God, which is an interesting phrase. Why does he put that in there? You might ask that question. By the mercies of God. What was the answer there? Yell it out. By the mercies of God. Everything he's talked about, this is kind of a grace word. He's been talking a lot about grace. And one aspect of grace is obviously grace is undeserved. And because it's undeserved, when God grants grace, it's looking down upon us. We need it. We are needy. We are in need of his mercy. And that mercy translates into his gifts that are all by grace. So you might go all the way back to the beginning of the book and see some of the things that call for mercy. He's talked a lot at the beginning on wrath. And that we're under wrath and we don't deserve anything. So verse 18 in relationship, and by the way, mercy is related and sometimes in each of these contexts in terms of wrath. We're in need of mercy in relationship to our standing before God. So it's by these mercies that now he's exhorting and encouraging. Talks about judgment in chapter 2, a major theme of the first few verses there. Is God's judgment. We're all under judgment. In that context, he's addressing primarily Jewish people or religious people, verse 5 of chapter 2. Again, because of that judgment, we're in need of mercy. Tribulation is a common experience, verse 9, and mercy to sustain us through tribulation and or to remove us from it. We need mercy in distress, kind of the same passage there, verse 9. And the possibility of perishing apart from Jesus Christ. God reached down and saved us. We use that. Paul doesn't use that word as commonly in the book of Romans, but the concept is there as well. Condemnation, we are condemned. We are in need of God's mercy to rescue us out of condemnation, verse 8 of 3. We're under sin. He describes us in that way. Spends three chapters dealing with our lostness and our ultimate need for mercy. Destruction. We're in danger of destruction. So God's mercy is to rescue us out of it. And our misery, verse 16 of chapter 3. We're in a miserable state apart from Jesus Christ. And even positive things, when he calls us beloved, it's on the basis of his mercy. It's not on the basis of anything we've done. So going back to chapter 1, these are the positive aspects, kind of the outworking of that mercy. We're called saints, not because that's what we possess. Well, we stand as saints, but we still also have the old nature. But God views us mercifully as saints. And again, the theme of grace, that's the essence of what mercy is all about, verse 7. He's granted us peace, also on the basis of grace and mercy, verse 7 of 1 and 1 of 5. We've been justified, that's on the basis of mercy, undeserved. Forgiven, chapter 4, 7. Sanctified, 6, 19. Given the Holy Spirit, the indwelling presence of the Holy Spirit, chapter 8, verse 11. All of these on the basis of grace and God's mercy. And these are only a sampling. So he says, therefore, on the basis of this, by the mercies of God. Now he's going to tell us how to live. And it's the essence of presenting oneself, and this is a moment-by-moment exercise. This is what it looks like, to live moment-by-moment presenting ourselves. That's the last part of chapter or verse 1. Present your bodies. Now, when he says bodies, he's just not talking physically. You really can't present your body without the right mindset, without the right attitude, without the right commitment. But I think what he's doing is he's going to begin to build some images here and bring the Jewish audience and those that are familiar with Judaism kind of into the thinking of the Old Testament. The Old Testament, you brought a physical body, an animal, and it was very visual. You saw blood spurting. If you were Jewish, you went to the temple and the animal was sacrificed. In fact, I've got some images to kind of remind you. Very visible. I don't want to use sensual, but the idea of the involvement of our whole selves, our whole body. So present your bodies. Well, we have another Greek word that we can look at. Present, paristemi is the Greek word there. To put one's disposal to something else or to someone else, and in this case to God, that's the object there. To put one at oneself's disposal, making oneself available, and that's moment by moment, day by day. That's what it looks like. And here, now he's going to give us the imagery of the Old Testament picture. You had a relationship with God based on your bringing of an animal for forgiveness of sin, for the ongoing aspect, a sacrifice. So if you were Jewish, the first thing you would think about is the altar in front of the temple. And in the first century, this is a model of the temple. So in your mind, you would have this image, you'd have this picture. And you have a close-up of it. Just behind that little structure there would be the altar. And on that altar, the priest would sacrifice an animal. And you'd see the blood. You'd hear the crying of the animal. And it was a very sensual experience. You not only visually, but you could smell everything that was going on. And certainly you would hear certain sounds. Very visual, very physical. And I think that's why he brings out the body aspect. And then the animal would be sacrificed on the altar, depending on the kind of sacrifice. In many cases, it would be a burnt offering. And again, you'd smell it and you'd see it. You're experiencing all of that. So translate that into the New Testament. We don't bring an animal, but what do we bring? Ourselves. So visualize yourself put on that altar, and you're making yourself available to God, disposing of yourself, dying to yourself. We saw that as a principle in chapters 6 through 8. So very visual. And then the common Old Testament language, Old Testament word, but here is the Greek word, thusia, a sacrifice. So all of those images the Jews would always think of when they heard the word sacrifice. Now, we're kind of detached from it, so we don't think about it that way. But that's what we ought to think about. We, as that animal, that helpless animal, placed there on the altar. Now, we do it voluntarily, and the animal obviously was forced, but we do it voluntarily. That's why he's urging us. That's why he's encouraging us. It's a special sacrifice. It's not an animal. It's a living sacrifice. The animal was slain. The blood was drained. But it's a living sacrifice. In other words, we can get off the altar, right? Or we can unwillingly go. Or we can refuse. But he says being a living and holy, in other words, we separate out or separate ourselves from our own desires. And now my desire is to serve the Lord. So it's a holy and living sacrifice. Holy, being separated, living, according to the principle of chapter 6, verse 4. The fact is we have a renewed life. Remember we talked about that when we're identified. Paul uses the word baptized into his death, burial, and resurrection. We have resurrection life, newness of life. He's alluding back to that concept that he developed in chapter 6. And it's acceptable. In other words, in the Jewish thinking, you had to have an unblemished lamb or an unblemished animal in a different situation. And similarly, acceptable to God. I think he's getting an attitude here. In other words, we have the right attitude in presenting ourselves. It's not something that we do like on a public scale where we're trying to impress others, but it's acceptable to God in that we have the proper attitude as well. So acceptable, pleasing to God. Anything that's pleasing to God is acceptable to him. And then the verse also includes worship. So our life is a day-by-day, moment-by-moment worship, and the presenting of our bodies is an act of worship. Just as the Jews would bring an animal, that was their act of worship. We present on an invisible altar ourselves, and that is worship. That's the essence of worship. So it's personal worship. Which is your spiritual logikos, can be translated rational, logical, reasonable. In this context, probably, so it has an intellectual aspect, but in this context, probably spiritual, as the New American Standard translates it. So your thoughts can be spiritual, by the way. And it's a service of worship. And again, Paul is bringing imagery from a Jewish context. Even the word service there was the work of a priest. So he uses the Greek word latreia. That's a common word that would have been used in the Septuagint for the sacrificing and the work of a priest as he offered the sacrifices. He would it would be a service. It would be the ministry that he would be involved in. So it's a Jewish word. It's a word that is associated with the whole priesthood of Israel. And he's using it in a New Testament context now in terms of you and I, moment by moment, doing the service of a priest, the one that God has called to perform the sacrifices. So lots of big words. So we've come to kind of one of the main things that he's trying to come across here. Put all these words together. Number one, the submitting to God moment by moment. So it's a moment by moment, day by day, week after week, commitment to the Lord. That's how all of this doctrine should work itself out. A relationship of an ongoing sacrifice of not what I want to do, but basically what God would have me do. And he wants to bless me. And when I do this, it's worship, and it's a worshipful experience, and it's a blessing. So, verse 2, well, we did pretty good. One verse. Verse 2, he's going to add to it. In other words, there's some other aspects to this moment-by-moment living. And I summarize verse 2 as the process of presenting. So verse 1 is the encouragement or the exhortation of presenting. And now what does it look like in other aspects, the presenting in verse 2? And there's some obstacles. So he's going to lay out the obstacles now, at least at the beginning there. The obstacle is going to deal with the present age in which we live in and the pressures that we're under. So Paul is very practical. He's not an ivory tower preacher here that is not aware that we face pressures every day, every time we get into any aspect of the world, whether we go out of the home or within the home as well. The world comes to us very easily, right? All you got to do is just open your phone, right? The pressures of the age, we're encouraged to resist them, so we have obstacles in the Christian life. It's not easy. It's not easy to present on that altar. So the next verse here, and do not, notice the and, so he's going to add to the principle that he developed already, do not be conformed to this world. So the word there, to be conformed, suskematizo, don't even try and pronounce it right, to be formed, to be conformed to something. It's like putting something into a mold. You put water in a different container and it takes the shape of the container. Well, our tendency is to take the shape of the culture in which we live in. The culture thinks along a certain lines that is unbiblical generally. And when we conform to it, we're basically shaping our thinking after whatever that form might take. And it takes various forms, but we're exhorted against that. So don't be formed or conformed to a particular worldview or particular ideas. And the word world here, translated New American Standard world, is actually the word that commonly refers to the age. So it's not talking about the planet per se, but it's talking more about the attitudes or the worldview, the age, the thinking of the particular age we live in. We live in an age that has departed a long way, and I'm talking about America. We were founded on biblical principles, but our country has wandered, and the culture, the society, has abandoned the biblical worldview. And if we're not careful, our thinking begins to conform to that worldview, to that age, or that period of time in which we live in. So the dangers of worldliness, I think what he's got here, just some practical things. Young people like to conform to the fashions. Not evil in and of itself, but if it's a priority, a high priority, or if there's excesses here, conforming in terms of fashion. Focus on money. Now, just getting closer to home for some of the adults here, right? We have to make a living, and there's nothing wrong with that. But again, the world says, you know, you've made your millions, but it's not quite enough, right? You need to make a few more thousands. So we tend to conform to the thinking of the world. Priority of careers, again, men have that sometimes overly emphasized in their lives. Power and position. We could just make a long list. I just came up with some suggestions here to think about. Now we're getting home to women, right? The impressiveness of the home. And, you know, it's not that God doesn't want us to have nice things and nice homes and cleanliness and all of that, but if that's an excessive area, then we're conforming to the thinking of the world. The latest gadgets, in my circle, the latest software, the latest phones and that sort of thing. Anyway, you could long list, investments, pleasure, indulgences. This is the thinking of the world, the distractions. So the first thing is submitting our thoughts, our minds, our attitudes, moment by moment. And then the danger, the second thing, the second major emphasis, setting apart from the world. We have to live in it, and lots of things are neutral. They're neither evil or good. But when they become excesses, then they become evil. And there are some things that are evil that are somewhat more obvious. But even the good things, we need to be on guard that we're not thinking in terms of the way the world thinks. So that's the second thing. Now he's going to add to that. He's going to give the alternative. Rather than being conformed to the world, we are to be transformed. So we're going to make some changes. So persistent transformation. And if you haven't figured it out already, you can see I'm using P's to alliterate here, presenting to God, the process of presenting, and the pressures of the age-resisted and now persistent transformation. So verse 2, but, here's the alternative, be transformed. Transformed. And that's an interesting word. Metamorphomai, total change from inside out, the idea of the word. So it's a change, a transformation, but it's not an external transformation. It's from the heart outward that is reflected in things that are visible, but it has to start with the heart, so it starts with attitudes. And he's going to talk about renewing the mind in a moment here. So it starts with our thinking, to have our thinking correct. It's going to be helpful here. And this transformation, I think God has given us kind of a visual picture. And he's given us a physical way of visualizing it. It's kind of like the formation and the growth process of the butterfly. It starts with an egg that transforms into this, what some people consider an ugly creature, a worm. And if you've seen some of them, they're a little hard to look at, I guess. And then it goes into a different stage. You're familiar with the biology here, where it's going to go through another transformation. And then the final transformation is something that is just totally different. And this creature is able to fly even and looks very, very much different from not only the beginnings, but even that intermediate stage there as a worm. That's kind of an illustration. I think God has given it to us to illustrate this transforming, where now in Christ we begin crawling, right? Baby Christians stumbling and not quite fulfilling all that God has for us, but he wants us to be set free and transformed in our living, and that transformation is going to allow us to fly spiritually and accomplish great things for God. So that's the concept there as we moment by moment present ourselves and being on guard, because our tendency is to conform to the world, the outworking will be a transformation that now we are very, very useful for God. So this is what it looks like in relationship to God, the outworking of chapters 1 through 11. And we call that metamorphosis. Do you see the similarity in that word and the Greek word? That's where we get the English word, is from that Greek word that talks about transformation. And it happens by the, at least the beginning of it, happens as a result of the renewing of our minds. So it starts in our thinking. And again, you guard against the thinking of the world, and our thinking has to be shaped by what God teaches. And Paul has laid out that new thinking in terms of the book of Romans, first 11 chapters, all of those principles, all of those concepts. But the rest of the New Testament gives us expansion of the things that Paul has written and new things, other areas of theology or doctrine or thinking. So the renewing of our thinking, and this again is a constant thing because our minds tend to wander, tend to go towards what the culture is talking about. So we need this. This is why we study the Bible moment by moment, day by day. It's why we have Bible studies. It's why you come on Sunday morning to continue this renewing of your thinking, that you stay on course. And that's part of the transformation process. So the renewing anakinosis, is that how you pronounce it? It's an inward again, an inward renovation. So begins inwardly. It's part of the heart attitude, the renewing of one's mind. And when it happens, it's going to demonstrate, it's going to be visible, and it's going to demonstrate certain things. Another P here, it's going to going to prove what God's will is. So people are going to be observing and seeing, and it's going to demonstrate, this is what it looks like. This is what it looks like to be a Christian. This is God's will for humanity. And people can observe you and how God can transform you, and it's a witness in itself, and it's going to prove what God's will is. So that's the last part. So that, purpose statement, so that you may prove, there's where I get the word, it's in the text, you may prove, and the rest of it, what the will of God is, but the proving here, an interesting Greek word, dokimazo, it's a common word, it has the idea of proving through testing. It's like an engineering word. We test materials in the engineering realm to make sure that they conform to the specifications that are required for those particular materials. I was involved in the construction industry for several years, and we would require that in the construction stage that people get samples of the concrete that was being poured, and they would mold these cylinders in order to take them to a testing lab, and the testing lab, after 7 days, would perform a test, pressure test, and then after 28 days, another one to kind of track the gain in strength of the concrete. That's the idea of dokimazo. It's to prove the reality of what the claims are, the reality of what actually exists, and in the case of concrete, it would show that the contractor purchased the concrete that met the specifications, and the test would prove it out, Living the Christian life, as we face trials, as we face different situations, it's going to demonstrate and prove the reality of the justification that we've experienced. It's going to demonstrate the reality of our relationship to God as people are seeing it, and it's going to demonstrate through testing, and the more difficult the test, the more evident will be the reality of what God has accomplished within us. So what is the will of God? So that's what the product of that test is going to show. That which is good and acceptable and perfect, because God is the one that is at work in us. So it's going to be visible. The Christian life should be visible to the unbelieving world, should be visible to other believers, and it should be an encouragement to other believers and a motivation to them that God can work in your life and can demonstrate His will in your life, because you are distinguishing that is of the world and that is of God, and you're able to live and walk according to the principles that God has given. So that gives us our third major emphasis of this passage. The first one, the encouragement to submit or to present oneself. Submit moment by moment, being aware that there are obstacles and the world's going to try and trip us up. But as we practice, as we do this, then we are being transformed into the image of Christ. And that's the goal. That's the purpose of the Christian life. And that's what's going to be demonstrated. That's the proof. And like I said, it is demonstrated as a result of the more difficult situation, the more evident will be the reality of the transformation. So we can conclude with a concluding slide here. And obviously the whole thrust of the passage is to encourage us to submit to God moment by moment. So a lot in a couple of verses, right? Well, that's just the beginning. There are other areas that Paul will get into, but it starts with this foundational area. If we do not have this right in our experience, then all of the other exhortations that he's going to follow in all of those other circles, we're not going to be able to handle those other circles. We're not going to be able to handle the things that God is exhorting in those other areas. So those are the first two verses. The foundation of it is a moment-by-moment walk, a reality of that relationship, of personal relationship with Jesus Christ. So may we be people that demonstrate it to a lost world and make people open to the verbal presentation of the gospel.